Liberty sees me, it stands by me, and celebrates me for who I am.
When I come into the office, I feel that I belong here.
I don't have to be corporate America Gabby. I can just bring Gabby to work.
Reach your potential and find a job you love at Liberty Mutual. We offer development training, rich benefits, and a culture that lets you bring your whole self to work so you can pursue your tomorrow today. Ready to consider a career at Liberty Mutual? Find out how at libertymutualcareers.com.
Hi, everyone. It's the Shegulola Salami Show, and I'm Shegulola Salami. If it's your first time listening to the show, I'm Shegulola Salami. Like I said, I'm an author, lifestyle blogger. I'm a mom, drinker of hot chocolate, lover of sun. The Shegulola Salami Show is a podcast show, obviously. It's set in a virtual cafe. It's about books and publishing. But not necessarily the way you might imagine. We have guests come on the show who are authors, and they talk about the writing process and how they get their books to your, you know, to your bookshelves. Or non-authors who talk about the books that they like or their specialty and make book recommendations, right? So it is a virtual cafe. I've just got a drink of water because for the first time in ages, it is sunny in London, right? And I'm just really thirsty. But anyways, it's a virtual cafe. So let's see who we've got here. So who have I got here with me in the virtual cafe?
Good afternoon, Shegulola. This is Ahmed Rashid.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks. Yourself?
I'm doing peachy. A little nervous about my the podcast here, but I'm very happy to be here and very pleased to meet you.
Pleased to meet you. So you were going to tell us about yourself and then I rudely interrupted you. Sorry.
That's okay. So let's see. How does my spiel usually begin? My name is Ahmed Rashid. I was born in Egypt, raised in Maryland, and I moved to Boston about 15 years ago. I work as a software engineer, but my life's passion, what I do for a living, is I teach people about Islam, and I host a lot of interfaith events, you know, trying to strive for greater harmony and understanding, as well as social justice in our communities.
Interesting. Well, I would love to hear more about that. But, you know, it is a virtual cafe, and I'm having nice ice cold water because it's hot. So what would you like to have? What's the temperature? What's the weather like in Boston?
So in Boston, it is definitely not hot. We had a few days of nice weather, but now it's turned cold again. There's an old joke up here that says that winter never lets go of Boston easily. New England, almost always it's a fight to get out of the cold weather. So we had some very nice weather last week, like in the, you know, maybe in the, let's see, I have to convert from Fahrenheit to Celsius, like in the high 20s. But now we're back down in the teens, in the 15, 16 degrees, 12 degrees Celsius right now. So I'm actually going to have a hot black dark roast coffee with extra sugar.
Fabulous. Well, my cafe can deliver anything you can imagine virtually. That's what awesome. Would you like with your dark roast coffee?
If you have any of those famous British scones, I would, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I usually like to have a little bit of pastry with my coffee.
Perfect, right? So we would do it with clotted cream and jam. How does that sound?
Sounds wonderful.
Okay, cool. Like I could literally have a whole podcast episode chatting about, you know, cream teas and scones. And I don't know why, but some people call it scones and some people call it scones. And I don't know, I just call it scones. So we're going to go with that.
Very good. Very good.
So, yeah. So tell me, you said you were quite passionate about Islam. So how did you develop that passion? Was it from your parents?
No, actually, I was kind of the odd one out. My parents were very much... I mean, they were cultural Muslims, so they had, you know, we went to prayer on Fridays, we would fast during Ramadan, but for the most part, you know, when they immigrated to the United States with me in tow, they were trying to live the American dream, just trying to move ahead. I didn't start getting serious about my faith until my parents went through a divorce. That was very difficult for me. I was about 8 years old when they started getting divorced, and I was 11 years old when they finished getting divorced. It was kind of messy, and I really did a lot of soul searching during that time. And then you know, I started getting a little more, you know, reading more about my faith, kind of even doing a soul searching process of my own. You know, what do I really believe? You know, I started questioning everything that my parents had taught me. And at the end, I did decide that, or I came to the conclusion on my own that Islam is the faith for me. And so I started little by little, you know, reading more, practicing more, you know, trying to be more observant. So that's what I was doing there. However, what my passion for teaching Islam, actually, I have an interesting, maybe a little bit of a tragic story about that, if you have the time for this. I didn't actually get serious about, you know, teaching Islam or learning about it and trying to be an advocate for my faith and also more into social justice until September 11, 2001.
Wow.
So I was in graduate school at that time. I was on the Speakers Bureau. I was in the Muslim Students Association. So it's called the MSA in America. It's like basically a faith club that many colleges have. And so I was on that in that club. And on that day, obviously those terrible events happened. And the dean of the school of that, I was at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania at the time. Basically, they stopped all the classes at around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. Everything was canceled. The cafe and the student center, you know, they offered like free cookies and coffee and things to people. Basically, that was a day that history stopped for us. And what they did is they went ahead and set up a podium and like a big table in the campus common area. So in Pennsylvania, it's not like Boston or New England. Even though it was, you know, September, it was very warm. So they just kind of decked everything out, put out a bunch of blankets and things on and tarps on the grassy lawn there. And people just started sitting down and they had, you know, a conversation. There was the dean of the school, the chairman of the religious studies department, the chairwoman of the political science department, and the chairwoman of the history department, kind of all sitting there and, you know, offering a forum for the students to kind of, you know, share their thoughts and their prayers. A lot of us being in Pennsylvania, we did have family in New York. And so there was a very, you know, very tense emotional time for the students there. My own sister at the time, she did in fact work in Manhattan. We didn't get in touch with her until 2 or 3 p.m. that day. So that was also a little stressful for us. So that's the setup of the scene there, is that we have the dean, three college professors sitting, trying to have a conversation with people. And then one young lady, I remember she stood up, and you know, she approached the microphone and she talked about how angry she was and how she would like to, you know, there was already speculation at this time that this was a terrorist attack and that the perpetrators were Muslim. And she said a few words about how she would like to find, you know, the people who did this and their relatives and any other Muslim that she could find and just kill them. So there was kind of like an awkward silence from the professors. And that's when I raised my hand and I asked the dean, could I respond to the lady, please? So I was a graduate student. Most of them were undergrads. And so I stood up and I made a little speech about, you know, due process of law and how we don't know who did this, and whoever did this, no religion would condone such an act. It is a cowardly act. It is a heinous act. It is an act. It's an evil act. And whatever faith tradition we have, the whole point of the faith is to enjoin what is good and to try to avoid what is evil or harmful. And I kind of capstoned with that, you know, we pray for the victims, we pray for the victims' families, but we must not let our emotions stand in the way of justice. And it is not just to, you know, do guilt by association. Even if it turns out that there are Muslims who did this, that does not mean that I condone this act or any of my fellow Muslims here condone it or any of our mosques or the rest of the world Muslim community. So that was kind of my statement. And ever since then, I've been getting requests to talk about Islam. There were a few, you know, interfaith events that happened on campus later that month, and then the next month after that, and the rest of the year. And because I was already a member of the MSA and I was already kind of on the Speakers Bureau, I just started getting more and more requests. And that's kind of, as they say, how it all started.
That was very interesting. And I think it was quite brave of you, you know, to have just stood up and, you know, giving your speech and sort of, you know, going for justice that, you know, what's it called? Guilt by association, you know, was not the right thing. So it's been quite an interesting journey for you. So since then, apart from the speaking opportunities that you've had, what else have you been doing?
So For the most part, when I was in Pennsylvania, there were a few, how can I put it? There were a few church visits that I did. I went to a few schools. You know, basically just kind of being the, you know, the kind of Muslim on tap, where I would just kind of go up, introduce myself like I just did, and then say, you know, I know that there are a lot of questions, a lot of fears, maybe a lot of anger and misconceptions about Islam. You know, what does Islam teach? What do Muslims actually believe? And so, you know, I would always open up my engagements to ask people, you know, what is it that you would like to know? You know, what issues do you have, or what questions do you have? And that's kind of what I was doing for most of that time. You know, I was, you know, the public relations officer at the MSA. So I visited churches, I visited temples and schools, you know, so Jewish and Christian outreach, as well as just being a, you know, a resource when I went to an elementary school or a middle school or a high school. And basically I always tried to keep things informal as I tried to study more and more, because there's a scholar in Villanova, his name was Dr. Mustafa Ahmed. You know, he ran an institute called the Foundation for Islamic Education, which was kind of like a, not exactly a seminary, but he would offer courses, you know, for like graduate level Islamic studies. And so I would go to those things. And I always felt that there was a big disconnect between the students who were trying to learn these things and the way that the professors would be teaching it, and just kind of breaking it down to the common man, the common person, or even the regular, you know, the common Muslim who doesn't have the time, you know, to go into the books and do these kind of theological and seminary type studies. And so I always try to break things down and make things easier for people to understand, and also, you know, give an insight to the political realities in the Middle East and what is it that's kind of generating all these grievances and all this anger. And I always end up coming back to the same point, in that, you know, religion is used as a justification or a catalyst, not for its own sake, but to address the political or economic or sometimes even social injustices that the people there are feeling. So, you know, a person is, you know, he's trying to be patient, he's trying to do this. There are communities which feel like they, you know, they're not getting their fair shake, that they're not being dealt with justice. And that's where I started doing more interfaith social activism, where I realized that the root cause of this kind of anger and these kinds of heinous acts, it all stems from basically someone being dehumanized. And so that in turn causes them to act inhumanely, you know, that when you strip the dignity of a human being from him, he does or she does become like an animal. They will lash out. They will, you know, they will act with anything that you could imagine to be disgusting and bad and whatever. And it all comes down to, you know, if you don't address the human dignity that has been insulted or that has been hurt, if that emotional wound, if that spiritual wound is not addressed, then it will fester and there will be, you know, very evil thoughts and actions that comes after that. So that's kind of what I've been doing, during my 3 years of graduate study. And then I came to Boston back in 2004. And I started basically, you know, volunteering at various mosques. And I found that there was a lot of desire for people to learn about Islam in a way that's not preachy. And that's kind of what my angle has always been. You know, many of the Muslim speakers that I talk to, they're very good at speaking to other Muslims and, you know, kind of giving a sermon about what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing. But there wasn't really, that was kind of the niche that I filled. There wasn't really anyone who could just explain Islam to people, kind of setting the record straight, you know, whether you accept or not accept. That's not my point. My point is, you know, at least understand what the actual teachings are, and then you can decide for yourself whether it's right for you or not. But there was so much negative media, so much misinformation, so many just false concepts about, you know, what does our book teach? What do Muslims actually believe? And that ignorance, you know, led to fear, and that fear, of course, leads to hatred and animosity. And so I kind of filled in that niche of just, you know, I started doing an Islam 101 class, like, this is what Islam teaches. And what I always used to build is that, you know, I'm not trying to sell you Islam. I'm just selling you accurate information about Islam. And that's kind of the class that I started back in 2009. I've been the head instructor there. I got two or three other teachers now that have been trained under me. And so they've kind of gone back to their mosques and keeping the class going, just really just being a kind of a you know, learn straight from the source what Islam teaches without any pressure to accept or not accept. But the idea is just, look, here is what most Muslims, the mainstream moderate Muslims, believe, practice, and try to, you know, uphold. And that's all we care about, is that we just want, you know, we just want you to know what is it, not whether, you know, it's correct or not or anything like that. Yeah. So that's kind of what I've been doing ever since, just having the class. I've also been trying to, you know, increase my own education, you know, taking online classes as well as going to various scholars, Suhaib Webb in Boston, Safi Khan down in Maryland, and just trying, and I'm working on a master's thesis right now, interfaith social activism. So we did a lot of interfaith work with two different synagogues in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as well as three different churches in Cambridge, Boston, and Brookline. So again, all around social activism. You know, we're doing food pantries, going to a woman's shelter and trying to help around there. We went to a senior center and, you know, did some activities with the elderly that are there, with these other, you know, with the other churches and the other synagogues. The idea being that, you know, we can do social good. We can give back to our community, and that crosses any religious divides, you know. And I found that most of the really powerful and like soul inspiring activity work that I have done has been in these interfaith, where we can, you know, we're helping the homeless, we're feeding the poor, where we're distributing, you know, food to the needy families around Boston. And we're doing this together, you know. All of our faiths, you know, kind of instructs us to take care of our neighbors. And this is one way that we can actually, you know, achieve that.
Oh, good. So whilst you're saying all this, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know what, you've done so much work, you should be an author.
And that's what happened around 2014. 2014, my younger brother, he's kind of a serial entrepreneur, although now he's kind of cleaned up his bachelor life and now has a steady job. But back in those days, he was working as a book publisher, where he'd help people kind of publish their stories. He was more of like, his niche was like memoirs and kind of like family legacy preservation, where he would help people make their scrapbooks, maybe write down the memories of their grandparents, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah. And so he approached me saying, hey, would you like to write a book, Ahmed? I was like, no, I'm not into that. He's like, no. You have all this information. You have all of, you know, all of this knowledge. You've been teaching this for so many times. You know, you should, you know, pass on your work to others. Like, well, I did that. You know, I have many classes at the mosque. Mm-hmm. We've done training for people who want to be speakers or you know, public speakers or even instructors at these kinds of classes. So, you know, I have these notes. It's done. He said, no, but you should do a book for like other people as well. So he finally convinced me. So in 2015, I hired him to write my first book. Basically, what I did is I said, "Look, I've been working as a volunteer for a yislam.org, which is a website based out of New Jersey in United States. They do kind of the same thing. They just kind of give information about Islam. And so one of the things that I was doing is I was being their correspondent. That's since 2010." Correspondent means that people come to their website, they ask for more information, and they ask for like a one-on-one email conversation. And then the dispatcher would assign me to various people, right? And so I had this whole repository of email conversations between me and some of these other people who would come to the website and say, I'd like to start a conversation about women's issues, or, you know, jihad, or, you know, political theory in Islam, or, you know, why do you guys pray, or what do you guys think about Jesus, or what do you think about this, or what do you think about that? And I started picking up some of the more negative comments. So because I've always tried to keep emotionally detached in my responses. You know, I am passionate about teaching, but what my dispatcher noticed is I was one of the few people on his volunteer team who was comfortable answering hate mail, because since September 11, that's kind of what I've been doing.
Yeah.
So I was very comfortable saying, I understand your frustration, I understand your anger, but let me show you our side of the story and explain things and you know, how these acts are not condoned by my faith, our faith, but here's why people are so angry, and here's where this anger in the Muslim world is coming from. And sometimes it works, sometimes, you know, people come around and they kind of understand the human side of us, and sometimes it doesn't. And that's kind of where, you know, where I got the matter, where I got basically the content of my books, is that It's a series of conversations, back and forth email conversations between me and different correspondents. And as I mentioned on my website, you know, I get all sorts of people. I get the people who are like interested in becoming Muslims. They want more information. I get those who are really hostile and they think that we're the third plague of the universe. And we got people in between, those who are concerned, those who are curious, those who are doing like a project for school, or those who want to get to know their neighbors better, that kind of a thing. And so I said, you know, this is a nice niche to be in. You know, there are a lot of books that, will explain Islam or criticize it or teach it, you know, from a missionary point of view. But what about just plain old fashioned conversations, you know, people asking straight old questions and getting honest answers, you know, that's something, you know, information that goes behind the headlines, right? You know, that they're, you know, we have academic people, hostile people, concerned people, soul searching people. You know, the focus of these books is reaching people who might not know or have talked to a Muslim, and offering a glimpse into our world.
Sorry, I was just going to ask. You said all these things, but you've not said what the name of your book is.
Oh, the name of the book is What Would a Muslim Say?
Where is it available?
It's available pretty much everywhere. It's available on Barnes & Noble's. It's available on Amazon. It's available in the Apple Store. And it's available on Kobo. Yep. So it's available both as a digital ebook as well as a paperback book.
Fabulous. See, now I'm quite curious though. You said your brother, you know, he helped you, publish your book, right?
The first one, yes. After that, he sees something shiny, he moves on to something else. And so I did the rest of them myself.
Okay. So did he help you self-publish the first one? And then have you self-published the second one or the subsequent ones?
Yes,
did you go with
that? Is correct. Yes. So he helped me publish the first one. So he basically was my editor, as well as my cover designer, as well as the one who set up the whole Amazon, the paperback book. And then after that, you know, I decided to do an ebook, but I did that one on my own because he'd already moved off by then. So he helped me publish the paperback book. He edited it. Basically, I forwarded him all those emails. I said, here, you take this and you format it, you know, make it look nice.
Yeah.
So that was most of, I would say 80% of his fees, or 80% of the money that I paid my younger brother, not just to help him out, but, you know, because this work needed to be done, was that kind of content editing, you know, of taking these congregant of conversations and putting them into something that would be interesting to read.
Yeah.
A few months later, I got a bit of feedback from various, beta readers, as well as, people who are my close friends. It's interesting, as an author, I realize, you know, it's kind of the maxim, never ask your friends or family what they think of your work, because it'll always be positive. You really need to go to the people who are outside of your circle, those who don't have a personal relationship with you, to get some honest, constructive criticism. Yeah. So that happened maybe three or four months later. I got some really, it was painful at the time, negative reviews from basically people who read my book and said, you know, this and this and the other. So I decided on my own, okay, I need to redesign the cover, and I need to do a really kind of an overhaul of the content inside to make it easier to read, more interesting for people to read. And so I did that. I made the second edition. That was in the summer of 2016. Mm. And yeah, so that's where I got the new cover. You know, so I commissioned a cover designer. I commissioned an editor, you know, to kind of go over everything. I also did a little bit of shuffling around, you know, reordering some of the conversations, doing some more editing, because one of the things about email is that people don't spell things correctly. Mm. And when I discussed with my brother about editing the book, he said, okay, how deeply should I cut into this? Because some of this grammar is pretty bad. So my initial idea was, I want this to be like raw. I want this to be like, you know, you have the misspellings in there, you have this, you have that. I really want it to feel like you're eavesdropping on somebody's email.
Yeah.
And he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I'm sure. And I realized that was a mistake. One of my negative reviews said, this is not like classified government documents. It doesn't have to be exactly word for word, punctuation for punctuation, accurate. You know, if somebody says something awkward, you should have the editor, you know, kind of clean up a little bit, so at least it is understandable what, the other person is saying. Yeah. And the second editor that I hired, he said that. He mentioned that, you know, for the most part, Ahmed, your responses are very, you know, well put together. You know, you're a good writer. But a lot of the visitors that you're conversing with, the correspondents, I mean, they cross the entire spectrum from well-spoken to pretty bad, yeah. You know. And so I fixed on that. And also some of the my own wording, I also cleaned that up. And that was kind of all on my own. So when I republished the book, the second edition, and then I did the second, the third, and the fourth book, that basically I took the template that my brother had made and then just updated it with the new content. I went through the emails myself and kind of, you know, kind of with my, now that I had all the feedback, the negative feedback, but it's constructive feedback, right? You know, people, you know, one of the things that as an engineer, I'm always hearing is that, you know, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the oil, yeah. Right? So as an engineer, I'm always called on, hey, can you fix this? Hey, can you fix that? Hey, can you fix that? And if nobody asks me to fix something, it ain't going to get fixed. And yeah. So the negative feedback that an author gets is actually more valuable than the positive. And I think that's part of the learning process, that you have to be willing to go through the you know, the first hump of negative feedback until you address those issues. And then hopefully, you know, God willing, you get nothing but positive feedback after that. Which I think I've done a bit of that. I still get a few negative reviews here or there, but that's usually from people who don't even agree with the concept or the motivation for me writing my book.
Yeah. But that's fine though, because I think it's impossible to get 100 people who would agree with you 100% of the time.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. And in fact, I remember I was, you know, kind of going through the different, you know, self-published blogs, and they said, hey, you know, don't feel bad about negative reviews. Look, J.K. Rowley, she has these negative reviews, like one-star reviews. And it's like, okay, if J.K. Rowley can't get 100%, you know, approval rating, you know, who am I to try to even, you know, think
exactly.
about that? Yes.
Exactly. Oh, wow. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you and just sort of learning how you got to where you are. Your story has definitely been quite interesting to listen to. But we've come to that time of day where I've got to go and pick up the little human from nursery. So I've got to kick you out of the Virtue Cafe. Okay. But before I do that, if anyone wants to connect with you, how can they do that? Are you on Twitter?
I am not on Twitter, but I am on Facebook, and I also have a website. So the website is www.whatwouldamuslimsay.net. So there you can either subscribe to my newsletter, or you can read the blog, or you can, you know, there's a contact button if you just want to shoot me an email. That is one way of connecting to me. The Facebook page is called Islam 101 Boston. So that's three words, Islam, then 101 space, and then Boston. And that's where basically all the, my class updates are posted, as well as some of the events that, you know, that the local events that I do, whether it's a speaking engagement or giving a sermon, or if there's a, you know, like a food pantry or a food drive or Habitat for Humanity that we're about to do, that's where they can connect to me. So either Islam 101 Boston on Facebook or whatwouldamuslimsay.net on the internet.
Fabulous. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Okay, so last thing, right? Can you just summarize five things you want any of the listeners listening to the show to take away from, you know, the time, you know, that they've spent listening to you? Just really quick, five points. You know, it could be about your book publishing process or what you've learned, you know, from speaking. Like, what can they use? Like, how would they gain confidence in speaking? Because not everyone can just walk up to a podium and start speaking. Like, you know, just something, what actionable points can they take away from listening to you?
Okay. So one thing that I, you know, what I really believe, what that one of God's gifts to humanity is the gift of speech.
Okay. Hello?
On the receiving end. That's, I think, one of the things that I remember one of my mentors mentioned, that this is one of the reasons why I'm a good public speaker, is because I really kind of put myself in the shoes of the listener and I speak to that listener. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, be humble, because many times we get blindsided by our negative emotions and then we become intolerant of any shortcomings that we see in others, but we forget to look closely at ourselves. You know, always be humble. You know, if someone is really antagonizing you, realize that it's coming from a place of fear or anger or disappointment or concern or worry. I mean, I can't tell you, there's at least a half a dozen of the conversations which I had that started off very hot, very hostile. And by the end of the conversation, you know, we're on cordial terms, you know, and this is very important. You know, be humble. Don't respond to negativity with more negativity. Absorb the negativity and then give back the positivity. And eventually the person will come around. Even if they don't agree with your point of view, at least they will come to the point of, you know, you have your way, I have my way. We can still, you know, live together under the same sky and then on the same earth. Yeah. And I don't know what else could I say.
No, that's it. If that's all you got, you know, that's perfectly fine. Thank you so much. And then just to remind myself again, you say the book is called What Will the Muslim Say?
Yes.
Perfect.
What Will the Muslim Say?
Yeah. Yes. Okay, perfect. Well, if you've been intrigued by anything Ahmed has said so far, you can go and check out his book, What Would a Muslim Say? If you've enjoyed listening to this show, this episode, please share it with everyone, you know, in your network. Please subscribe to the show. And until next time, it's the Shegilal Salami Show. Bye now.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.